Welcome to Night 16 of the 1001 Nights podcast. Each episode, we bring you the ancient mythologies of the Arabian Nights as reinterpreted by modern authors. This week, we feature the story of the Second Mendicant by Laurie Goldstein and the tale of the Third Mendicant by Jacqueline Backus. The stories of the 1001 Nights are famously told by Scheherazade in order to enrapture the Sultan in a heroic effort to both forestall her execution and save her people. In case you need a reminder, in the last night, the three one-eyed drug dealers, also known as the Mendicants, were telling the strange and beautiful ladies of Baghdad their stories to convince them to spare their lives. The second drug dealer had told them about how he used to be a renowned screenplay writer, a veritable prince of Hollywood, until he was disgraced and forced to work as a grip on a movie set. While digging a hole, he had discovered a beautiful woman held captive by a powerful djinn, and they had fallen deeply in love. However, when the djinn discovered them, he broke the spirit of the woman, casting her forever into darkness. And, through his power, forced the prince to become a lowly actor, who was contractually obligated to wear a horrible ape suit. The prince was telling the ladies of Baghdad how he could hardly stand the ape suit when morning dawned and Scheherazade ceased to tell her tale. The Sultan had so badly wanted to know the end of the story that he had allowed Scheherazade to live another day. And so we find them together on the 16th night. Scheherazade lies beside the Sultan in their grand bed. A single candle flickers lazily, casting echoes of the intricate carvings in the mahogany onto the rich cloth trappings that hang down all around them. Scheherazade glances at the Sultan, inquiring with her eyes as to whether she should begin her story for the evening. And the Sultan nods, for he cannot abide the darkness nor the silence without distraction. And so she plunges once again into the world of the Prince of Hollywood and Cole the Porter.
The only food, not that I could eat it, for there was but a tiny hole in the mask through which I could consume food solely in liquid form, was liverwurst on week-old toast. But it was the writing that made me itch even more than the costume. I knew my soul had truly been sold to the devil with each line that was read. This was my penance for all I had done wrong in my life, my father's life, and his father's before him. One day, when a particularly awful line came out of the lips of the lead actor, even he couldn't take it anymore. He flung his sword to the ground and shouted, "Enough! I could write better than this!" The actor, playing the quirky best friend beside him, spoke up.
"Me too."
"And me," came the costume designer.
"And me,"
said the grip. "And me," said the server of the liverwurst.
"And me,"
said the ape. They all stared at me, especially the screenwriter who was on set as usual. His cheeks flamed cherry red, and then he growled, "Then do it." The relief in the director's eyes preceded his command for us all to try, imbued with the tone of a desperate plea for one of us to succeed. We all sat around a table, snacking on dry toast. Them, me on a smoothie made from curdled milk and moldy strawberries, and scribbled away with short pencils stolen from a mini-golf establishment. When we were finished, the director gathered our pages, labeled with numbers instead of names to ensure fairness, and brought them to the king of the film, the producer. After the king had read all the pages, we were summoned before him, though I, as the ape, was told to remain behind. "Number 8," the king said with pride. "That's the talent we need." The lead actor, the quirky best friend, the grip, the liverwurst guy, and the director all laughed. The king responded angrily. "Why are you laughing? Do you enjoy creating garbage instead of art?" The director stepped forward. "We're too sick of the stench of this, but it's just that number 8 happens to be an ape, not a talent." The eight is an eight? What the hell are you talking about? Perhaps it's a new director we need. The director cleared his throat. No, an ape. A-P-E. He's our ape. At least I think he is a he. An ape, a gorilla, a unicorn. I don't care what shape he is, the king said. Slap a pair of your trousers on the beast so long as you can put a pen in his hand. And so they did. The king commanded me to write the next scene. And when I did, he laughed when he was supposed to, and shed a tear when I hoped he would. And then he had all manner of delectable fruit and nuts and yogurt whirled together into a concoction that could have been served in a Michelin-starred dining room. When I had finished, the king told the director to bring forth the lead actress, who had more talent in the quarter inch of the dark roots invading her blonde locks than the entire cast. She also happened to be the king's daughter, and a loyal and a kind one, for she was surely degrading herself to act in this pathetic excuse for cinema. It turns out that not only was her talent superior, she was also gifted with more intelligence than everyone else on set combined. For when she read my pages, a look of recognition crossed her face. "Take off his mask," she said, "for this is no ape. This is the wronged King of Hollywood's son. This is a prince. I'd recognize his hand anywhere." The king regarded my face, lined with thin red scratches from the barbed wire inside the mask, with amazement. "Is this true?" I nodded. "Why then, you will be our new scribe." I paused. "But I'm under contract. It cannot be broken." That is what the djinn had said when he left me here in the form of an ape. The daughter held the sheet of paper in her hand. "Perhaps not by the ordinary film company, but I have been skilled in the art of breaking contracts." She eyed the cast around us. "This is not the first piece of garbage I have acted in." Her eyes flickered to her father. "Sorry, Dad." He waved her off. "No matter, for it will be the last with this ape or man by our side," her father said. "Break the contract, my daughter." "With pleasure," she said, whipping out her own eye device. Almost immediately, the beginnings of the hurricane swept the liverwurst from the table, and the djinn appeared. "You!" he cried. But he was not speaking to me. He was speaking to her, to the king's daughter. "This had all your enchanted markings," she said with disdain. "We swore an oath. We were never to oppose one another. Do I need to remind you of your beginnings and to where you can easily return?" The djinn set his own eye device to play on the monitor, and before us ran a string of clips. The daughter as a serpent, as an eagle, as a wolf. Then she played her own. The djinn as a lion, a scorpion, black cat. On and on the two dueled with their mutually pathetic histories in this perverse and strange land of Hollywood that each had acted their way out of, from animal costumes and bad roles in awful TV shows, and even worse plays and unwatchable films, to overcome them all to be the actress and djinn they now were. Was this right here evidence of the djinn merely being man and not magic? For if he were magical, surely he would have clicked his wingtips and not endured the long climb up the Hollywood ladder. Then again, of the djinn's many traits, an ego the size of the Hollywood sign might have been his biggest. He'd probably be too proud and conceited to think of stooping to magic to achieve success. By the end of their duel, the djinn's device was so overloaded that it burst into flames in his hand. He flung the burning contraption across the room, where it collided with a second-hand light that was prone to sparks all on its own. The light popped and cracked, sending a trail of flames down the fraying extension cord, where they met with the ancient generator that exploded like pyrotechnics on my People's Choice Award film. flashes of light, electric charges, and then flames, sparks, and shrapnel shot out. Before I could take cover, something leapt at me, landing in my eye, burning me blind. The king fared just as bad, with a flame alighting his beard and shrapnel taking out his front teeth. The actor suffered worst of all, with a burn down the side of his face that would transform him from leading man to burn victim number two for the rest of his career. And yet, it would not actually be the actor who suffered worst of all. It would be the king's daughter who freed me from my bind as an ape by successfully destroying my contract. But it would cost her everything. For me to break free and defeat the djinn, she had to destroy not just him, but herself. She uploaded a video that neither of them would ever want the world to see. Careers, lives, destroyed in the touch of a button. Knowing he had been bested, the djinn turned ashen and pale and retreated into what would be a cloud of scandal to hang over him for eternity. But the cloud housed the king's daughter as well. Grief befell us all, most especially me, who wished more than anything that I could have taken her place. I had already been ruined by scandal. I had committed sins. I should not be free through the actions of another so kind. The king's daughter went into hiding, locking herself away from all she loved, never to return to the spotlight. The cast wept. The king wept. I wept. But the film, with my new script, was finished. It was a monument to the king's daughter. To take from the ashes this film that was destined for the landfill and turn it into something worthy of her sacrifice. Shortly after completing the film, the king fell ill. He called me to his side and unburdened himself with all he'd been keeping inside. What we churned out before your arrival may have stank like day 12 of a city garbage strike, but we were happy. It is when you came to us that all was lost. I am proud of my daughter for freeing you. But it was at the cost of herself. She is gone. I am soon to be gone, and now you, my son, need to leave this place. All that has happened cannot be changed, but we depart still as friends. Go in peace. And so I left. I stopped to the nearest barber and had my hair, which had grown to my shoulders, and my beard, which was lush and full, both shaved. In the Goodwill store next door, I found a backpack much like the one I had oh so long ago, and with it slung over my shoulder, much lighter than the weight of the burdens in my heart, I traveled from city to city in the hope of meeting the Prince of the Faithful and telling him my tale. Jafar and Khalil, the two men in suits, exchanged quick glances as the attention in the room shifted to the third dealer. His voice was quieter and higher than the other two.
Medicant, beggar, wanderer. They call me a few things. I call myself a dervish. I am a spiritual being. I find spirituality within myself, within the world. I'm very superstitious, which will make sense once you hear my story. I'm prone to misfortune, which is maybe a balancing out of the very good fortune I once had. Because you can never have too much of the good things. I was not always a dervish, though. Once, a long time ago, I had two eyes. I was born the son of kings. Kings beget kings beget kings. I was a king, too, when I got older, when my father died, when I was tall enough to sit on the throne. People told me I was a just and worthy king, which was very nice of them to say, because I was not seeking out their opinion. When I was king, I loved taking ocean voyages. Sometimes I would take them on kingdom business. Sometimes I would just go sport fishing. Sometimes I would just sit on my boat in the middle of the sea where it was quiet and eat lobsters by myself. My last voyage, I had planned to be gone for a month. I had 10 ships with me, and together we planned to cross a vast expanse of water and emerge on the other side, sea-legged and triumphant. Days of travel became weeks, and then the wind stopped. Our sails went weak, and we sat. And then the dead fish came.
Ah, but I see the light of day is dawning outside the bedroom. So I guess you'll never know what happened to the third medicant, or Cole the porter.
But so badly did the Sultan desire to hear the end of the story that he allowed Scheherazade to live for one more day, so that she may finish her tale the following night. The 1001 Nights podcast is produced by Morgan Dubin and me, Nathan Kane. Scheherazade is played by the wonderfully talented Ariel Siegel. The story of the second mendicant was written by Laurie Goldstein. The story of the third mendicant was written by Jacqueline Backus. The music for the 1001 Nights podcast is generously contributed by Hey Van Laura Lemmy, Damscray, Pharaoh's Daughter, and Eric Hopton. To find out more about the 1001 Nights podcast, visit us online at 1001nightspodcast.com. There, you can find information about the stories you heard tonight, the original tales of the 1001 Nights, and biographies of all the authors who have written for this podcast. Our new intern's really working out here at the 1001 Nights podcast. Unlike the last three, he hasn't stolen anything. He doesn't just simply demand school credit for things. And best of all, this afternoon he walked in with a huge grocery bag in his arms.
And then he had all manner of delectable fruit and nuts and yogurt whirled together into a concoction that could have been served in a Michelin-starred dining room.
I think it's safe to say he was a fantastic hire. All right, that will do it for night 16 of the 1001 Nights podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and good morning.